Welcome into Words with Wallace. I'm your host, Nick Wallace. Coming at you, it is Saturday, June 21st, and we are one day away from the best event in all of basketball, Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Definitely the biggest game that I've had the privilege to cover, I guess, talk about since I started this podcast a couple years ago. Never in a million years thought this would be the NBA Finals that we get another Game 7. It's the first one that we've had in 9 years since the 2016 Finals, and I'd also say that this is already the best finals that we've had since then. Hopefully we don't get a dud tomorrow night. But let's talk on this podcast about what took place in Game 6. I mean, that was a weird game. Didn't expect to get a full 12 minutes of garbage time with Indiana running OKC out of the gym in their last chance to play in front of their home crowd. So we are going to talk about that. We're obviously going to spend most of the time previewing Game 7. Not that I know what's going to happen. Again, I know nothing of what to expect anymore in this NBA Finals series, but let me just tell you what I'll be watching for in Game 7 and just kind of lay out the stakes for each team heading into a win-or-go-home matchup. So Game 6 on Thursday night was probably not the result that anybody expected. You know, I'm really not that surprised that Indiana came out and won, especially in front of their home court. Like, again, every time people count out this team, they just continue to perform time and time again, even with the Haliburton injury that was getting so much attention heading into that matchup. Again, not shocked that Indiana won, but it was just the result. The fact that OKC really just had no answer whatsoever on either end of the court, right? I don't even know what I would blame it more on, like OKC not moving the ball enough, not creating enough good looks, and not generating enough good offense, or the fact that they allowed like basically 60 something points in the first half. Like, I can't even tell you the last time a generationally good defense like OKC allowed that many points in a single half. So it was just terrible all over the place for OKC, offensively, defensively, in transition from all the turnovers that they had in that game. It was a mess really all game long, but it didn't necessarily start out where like OKC came out crazy flat. I did just go back and rewatch, not the full game, but I did rewatch the first half just to try to get a sense at when the wheels kind of came off for OKC. And they actually started the game up 10-2 against Indiana. And I think the big spark really came from Pascal Siakam. You know, he got a couple of big buckets when they hadn't even had a field goal during the first couple minutes of the game. And then Nembhard immediately answers right away as well by drilling back-to-back threes. And then from that point forward, Obi Toppin and TJ McConnell check in the game. TJ has this just ridiculous no-look, like karate chop steal off of like an outlet pass by Jalen Williams that really sparked up the crowd. And then immediately after that, Obi Toppin drilled back-to-back threes. I just wanted to spend one more second on that TJ McConnell steal though, because it was really like one of those animations that you get in 2K or maybe like an interception in Madden, where you're so pissed off because you're like, well, the defense, like, they're not even facing the right direction. Like, there's no way he could have known where that pass was coming from. And, like, again, only TJ McConnell is making plays like that. In a series where, again, generational defense on one side and then a very well-coached Pacers team, like, he is the only guy with the level of hustle that stands out among a pack of elite athletes, all in theory doing the same thing. Like, it doesn't make sense how he continues to pull these plays out of his ass. But let's keep going down the line with Indiana here and kind of who stood out. A lot of attention when we saw the Pascal Siakam video from, I guess, like the pregame huddle that hit my timeline like right before tip-off. Like, I'm not kidding here. It looks like Pascal Siakam, when he's, again, in the huddle surrounded by his teammates, like his eyes kind of like roll back in his head for like a second there. And it really just goes hand in hand with like this devil magic shit that the Pacers have had going on this entire playoffs. And naturally, Pascal delivered another incredible game, 16 points and 13 rebounds. And I know that that's not super impressive, but again, the entire fourth quarter was garbage time. So he played a few less minutes than what he would have seen in a normal game in which they needed him to be out there. I'd probably bury the lead here a little bit. Talking about Tyrese Haliburton, I said it on my last podcast that even though he had a really miserable game in Game 5, and he obviously is dealing with something, I'm not saying that, but I will say that he moved pretty well eye test-wise, just like kind of watching him and watching the big plays that he had in Game 5. And, you know, Game 6 was no different, right? He wasn't necessarily hot to start, right? He didn't come out the gates like drilling shots or anything like that. But in typical front-runner fashion, once the Pacers had a little bit of momentum, he kind of stepped up, started making some threes, and even had like moments where he attacked the Shai Gilgeous-Alexander closeout and blew right by him, got to a floater and finished that. Quickness-wise, it was all there. I am mostly joking about the front-runner thing before this insane like Pacers run that they've had this postseason. A lot of people on Twitter like to call Tyrese Halliburton a front runner because he's often like talking smack. He's like going back and forth with guys, and it's always late in the game when the Pacers are up. So needless to say, he did play well. You know, it wasn't the best Halliburton game that we've seen, but he looked more or less like himself. And again, they were able to preserve him for the most part in the second half because the last full quarter was just garbage time. So I felt like OKC honestly didn't do enough to attack him on the defensive end of the court. Now, I got to give Halliburton some credit there as well. Like, defensively, he has been much better than what we've come to expect from Tyrese Halliburton, especially with some of, like, the plays that he's made on the defensive end, right? He's been in the right spot at the right time, coming up with a lot of loose balls, forcing a lot of deflections, causing a lot of steals. He's been pretty solid on that end of the court, but he's able to stay solid if he's not being dragged into the action almost every time down for OKC. And especially when their offense was pretty abysmal, like, all game long. Like, you'd think that Mark Daigneault would have kind of keyed in on that a little bit more. So that's definitely something to watch as we head into Game 7. While we're on the topic of Tyrese Halliburton, the best sequence of the entire NBA season, make no mistake about it. It was, like, with a minute or two left in the first half, Halliburton actually was, like, attacking Caruso on the offensive end of the court. It was just like an insane closeout from Caruso, and Caruso forces up like a tough fallaway jumper. Halliburton thought he got fouled, so he's like laying on the ground, and then Jalen Williams gets the ball. He's advancing it up the court. He doesn't expect Tyrese Halliburton to be in the play, so naturally Halliburton kind of comes over with like a soft double and forces a steal on a pass. Then he comes down the court. I'm sure you guys have seen the highlight by now. Like, I guess no look, but he really was looking, but he has like an insane like spin pass in transition to Pascal Siakam, who just murders Jalen Williams at the rim. Like, just such an incredible highlight play. I just wish at that point, and it was a great call by Mike Breen, I wish that they can embrace the crowd noise a little bit more and just kind of lay out for moments like that. Because, you know, Indy was buzzing at that point. They're up 20 points at that point, and then I think Siakam had one more turnaround at the end of the half to put him up by 22. And, you know, before we really knew it, even though we've seen some crazy comebacks in the postseason, it definitely felt like in that moment, Indiana was going to run away with the game. So huge credit to, of course, Halliburton and Siakam. It's only right that they are the ones making a spectacular play like that to ignite the crowd and, you know, probably ended up sealing that Game 6 win. So just had to draw attention to that play in particular for Indy. Obviously, like I said earlier, Obi Toppin was great. Andrew Nembhard, you know, I mentioned him hitting a couple shots early. He was fantastic throughout this game, and especially with the defense that he played on SGA, like, SGA still got to his shots. He still made some highlight plays. You know, we're going to talk about his 8 turnovers here in a second. But overall, I just feel like from like a man-to-man perspective, like, you're asking one guy basically the entire game to just go out and guard the MVP and arguably the best scorer in basketball right now. There's nobody up to that task quite like Andrew Nembhard. Indiana has probably the best matchup possible for that, which is crazy because Shea's obviously had some great games, and it's very possible that he goes off for a 40 ball to win the NBA Finals in Game 7 here. Like, even that wouldn't be shocking. But I just feel like if you're Indiana, you're just so happy with the way that you're guarding Shea Gilgeous-Alexander right now. Even if he's going to get to his spots and, like, he's going to get, you know, at least 25 points, really, no matter what you do. But again, the effort from Nembhard was incredible. Toppin hit a couple threes. He was magnificent in this one. And again, TJ McConnell, it's just like every game now after that karate chop steal. He didn't do much in the first quarter, missed a couple shots there, but the second quarter was all his. Like, those, you know, full on, every amount of effort he can possibly muster to, like, get into, like, a pull up jumper from, like, 8 feet out. Like, again, nobody is moving like TJ McConnell and what he's doing this final series. So that's all the love that I have to show for Indy in Game 6. Moving on to the OKC side of things, I think what really stood out was the lack of easy shots that they were generating, I guess, or at least the easy shots that they were making, right? The assist numbers in the first half, again, when the game was actually competitive, were pretty striking. 3 assists in the first half for OKC versus 13 for Indiana. Obviously, the final numbers on the full game, and you throw in the garbage time fourth quarter, those numbers got a little bit closer to one another. But still, 3 assists versus 13 in the first half is really tough for an OKC team that, yes, they obviously have 2 guys that are fantastic in isolation situations. But you would think that their MO all season long is like, hey, we force turnovers, we get out and run in transition, and that leads to easy looks. And they have a team of great passers. Their center is one of the best passers in the entire NBA. Hartenstein at his position. You know, obviously Shea, Jalen Williams, Chet, all those guys I wouldn't say are individually selfish players, but at some point you need to convert on the easy looks that you're able to generate just from passing the basketball. And OKC was unable to do that. Like I mentioned a little bit earlier, Shea had 8 turnovers in this game, which again is even more shocking when you think about the fact that he didn't play at all in the fourth quarter. So 8 turnovers in 3 quarters is rough. I did go back and watch all of them. I would say that about 6 of them were his fault. He gets a pass on 2 of them just because 2 of those passes, like I think both of them came in the third quarter where he was targeting Isaiah Hartenstein and Kaysen Wallace. Like those guys just like bobbled it. They had wet fish for hands. That wasn't Shea's fault. He gave them the ball in an advantageous situation and they just didn't catch it for whatever reason. That's just the type of night that OKC was having. So I have to give Shea a little bit of credit there, but 6 turnovers is still rough, man. You know, he's never really going to have like that bad of a shooting night. Like even last game, he still shot like just below 50%, which you're probably going to live with if you're OKC in that situation. But you know, the 6 turnovers where he's dribbling into a crowd, he's just being a little careless with the ball. He had a couple bad passes himself. Like that just really plays right into Indy's hand. OKC really has to win the turnover battle if they want to be confident that they are going to go out and win the game, because that's been their MO all season long. And Shea's 8 turnovers definitely did not help OKC with that last night. I actually, to give OKC a shred of positivity here, I really liked how J-Dub played, especially in the first half. Like, it still seems like Indiana has no matchup for him that they're comfortable with. It seems like he's able to do whatever he wants, mainly on Aaron Nesmith. That's been the matchup, which is, again, just kind of funny. Nesmith is a fantastic defender, but some matchups are different than others, and just the physicality of Jalen Williams, he just seems to be able to get to his spot and get to the rim at will, and he actually did that pretty consistently in the first half. Now, he had a pretty miserable third quarter like the whole Thunder team did, and so he only finished the game with 16 points, but a lot of people are looking at the stat line and what he did in game 5 and the 40 points. And yes, that was all magnificent. And now people are kind of ripping him apart for being a part of that miserable effort in game 6. But I think he was a little bit closer to the game 5 J-Dub than what the box score would lead you to believe. I still think that that's something that OKC should really look to exploit, especially if they're going to continue to double team Shea as much as they have. Like Jalen Williams could easily end up being the hero for OKC in this one. And I think that they should still be really confident in his matchups. I really didn't like the Aaron Wiggins minutes. Just another thing that I noted, like he actually had one play in the third quarter where it looked like a clip from like LA Fitness with like some of the dribble moves that he just like pulled out of nowhere, which made no sense because they were down like 20 something points. And so he's doing like some hot sauce ass dribble moves, almost loses the ball once, gets the ball back and does it again. And then finally, like the third ridiculous move that he did ended up turning into a turnover, and then it became immediately Indiana transition, and Aaron Wiggins himself actually fouled Obi Toppin on like a drive to the basket. So really did not like the minutes from Aaron Wiggins. Not that you're expecting all that much from a role player like that on the road, but we are going to talk more about what to expect from role players like him in game 7, and they're going to need a much better performance there. And ultimately Chet Holmgren as well. It's taken me way too long to say his name. He had actually a beautiful move on Pascal Siakam in like the first 4 minutes of game, and then had another bucket like right after that where he took advantage of, I think, Nembhard on him, just having a smaller defender on him in the post, and finished nicely. But like after those first 4 minutes, Chet looked like he was from like the first half of Space Jam where they zapped the NBA player's talent. Like he was rough. I mean, there was one in particular where Isaiah Hartenstein got the ball at like the mid post and then had like a textbook lob to Chet like you see all the time from OKC because the defense broke down. And Chet just missed a dunk. Perfect pass. Literally just had to tap it into the basket, and he couldn't even do that. And at that point, you just kind of knew Chet was not going to have a good game. I mean, I think he's shooting like 11% from 3 on the series as well. So it's been overall really rough for Chet Holmgren. We'll see if he can bounce back as well for Game 7. So let's move on and talk about what we can expect tomorrow night in Game 7. I still can't believe that we're here at this point having the best NBA finals that we've had since 2016. And I don't say that lightly. Like, I enjoy the finals every year, really, no matter what, no matter who is playing in it. Obviously, last year, I enjoyed the finals experience more than what I've enjoyed this year, just having my team have the opportunity to win it all. But, you know, going year by year, obviously, last year wasn't the best product or a good product whatsoever if you were a casual fan. Game 1 had some moments and whatnot, but besides that, there was really never any doubt that Boston was going to come out on top. Year before that, you look at Nuggets Heat in 2023. Again, that was kind of a snooze fest. The Nuggets won in 5, and most people picked Denver heading into that one anyway. 2022, you know, none of those games really came down to the wire all that much. Obviously, I hated that, having my Celtics lose to the Golden State Warriors, but if you were a big Steph Curry fan, that was a pretty cool run for him and really cementing himself as one of the all-time greats by going on that really unexpected run where he was arguably the best player in the world. 2021, that one I think is slept on quite a bit. That was the Bucks-Suns NBA Finals. I think that was really competitive and pretty surprising that the Bucks were able to come back after, I think, losing the first two games of that series. You had the iconic, you know, Drew Holiday steal to that Giannis alley-oop and some other big plays along the way. So that one was really fun, but ultimately the Bucks won that in six games. Before that, 2020, awkward finals. You're looking at the Miami Heat and the Lakers facing off in the bubble. 2019 was pretty entertaining to see if the Warriors could pull it off despite all the injuries, but ultimately they lost Klay Thompson, they lost Kevin Durant against the Toronto Raptors, and the Raptors obviously came out on top. 18 and 17, I mean, those were just like the dominant Warriors years, right, where they had Kevin Durant, and I think they won in 4 and 5 games respectively. Obviously, game one of, I think, the 2018 finals was a masterclass where LeBron had one of the best games of his entire career, and then J.R. Smith forgot to score, and they couldn't even get a shot up, and after that, I think the Warriors ended up sweeping the Cavs in that series. And then that brings us, obviously, all the way back to 2016. Game 7, Warriors-Cavs, the block by James, the insane shot by Kyrie to ice the finals. That's the level that we're talking about with this current NBA Finals. Honestly, like, again, Game 7 determines everything if it'll be on the same level of 2016. And that's really all people remember from 2016 was the 3-1 comeback, you know, the Draymond suspension, the block by LeBron and the incredible LeBron-Kyrie performances along the way. But it's all really kind of rooted in that awesome Game 7 finish. If Game 7 is a complete dud tomorrow night, which I'm not necessarily expecting and certainly not what I'm hoping for, it definitely won't rival 2016. But Games 1 through 6, if you look at what we've had this year compared to Games 1 through 6 of that 2016 Finals, it's really no contest. I think this year, this Finals series was way better. You know, the Indiana comeback in Game 1, I think Games 3 and 4 were a lot of fun as well. Game 5 was pretty close. You know, Game 6 and Game 2, those ones were kind of snooze fest. But to have like 4 competitive games so far and a couple of them that were really exciting, and again, that buzzer beater in Game 1, like, we're in pretty rarefied territory. And this was the last thing that anyone was expecting, right? OKC, heavy, heavy favorite coming into this one. Don't know a single person in my life that actually picked the Pacers to win. And that kind of brings us to the first thought exercise that I have around this Game 7 of who has more to lose in this NBA Finals. Gut, you would say OKC, right? Just because of all the heat that they're going to take if they lose in 7 games and lose back-to-back games to close this series when they were clearly a more talented team on paper. They're also the healthier team on paper because Halliburton is evidently dealing with something, even though we don't know the severity of that calf strain exactly. But I would say that Indiana probably has more to lose just because I do think it is less likely that they make it back to this point. I respect Indiana as a team, as a franchise, more than what I ever would have expected. So I am giving them their flowers and I'm saying that it is not fluky that they are here, but it is still so difficult to get to this point. So many things have to go right. And it remains to be seen if Indiana's unique style, if people are going to start to figure that out as time goes on. And I think they have the less talented team, so it's less likely that they make it back to this point. And I think if Indiana wins this, you know, they are going to be one of the most memorable teams of all time for the heroics that they've been able to pull off each and every round. I think that opportunity on its own, I think they might have more at stake. OKC is going to get dragged more if they lose to this Pacers team, and, you know, maybe they kind of deserve it, but I would say that overall, Indiana probably has more to lose. I think my favorite thing about Game 7 is that any player that steps foot on the court in the game tomorrow night has a chance to be, like, immortalized in basketball history, and that really isn't an exaggeration. And we've seen it time and time again this entire NBA Finals where role players have stepped into games, come off the bench, and immediately impacted and ultimately swung the result of these games. And so, kind of going through the exercise of who that might be in Game 7, like, I have no fucking idea, right? I have no idea what to expect tomorrow night, but I at least want to lay out the case for the most likely Game 7 heroes, the most unlikely Game 7 heroes, the funniest Game 7 heroes, and ultimately my pick, because there really are that many role players that are going to see significant minutes tomorrow night. I think the most likely Game 7 hero rankings, I would say for OKC, I would say it's probably Alex Caruso, and I'd say for Indiana, it's probably TJ McConnell. Like, Caruso, he's had a quiet last couple of games. I think he was like a complete no-show as far as scoring any points last game, which isn't that surprising with how little the ball was moving around. But he did have some really big 20-plus point performances earlier in this series. And then, of course, TJ McConnell. I mean, you guys don't need me to talk about him anymore. Like, it's not a fluke what he's doing. Like, he's had 3 to 4 massive games already in the series where really, like, yeah, it ends up being like 12 points and 6 assists and, you know, 4 rebounds, which is great. Like, that's a great stat line for anybody, and especially in the amount of minutes that McConnell plays. But it's just what he does if you're watching the game, the energy in the crowd if they're at home in Indiana. You know, just the hustle plays that he's making on both ends. It's just a complete momentum swing every time TJ McConnell seems to check in. So, again, I would say most likely it's Caruso and McConnell. Most unlikely for each side, I'd say it's Cason Wallace for OKC and Miles Turner for Indiana. Cason Wallace, again, like last night, had a couple looks where he was wide open. Really the best shot that you could possibly generate, and they're just not falling for the guy right now. You know, he's still giving you a lot in the defensive end of the court, but offensively, he's not moving at the same speed that we saw from him, certainly during the regular season and even in previous rounds. So it'd be pretty unlikely for Cason Wallace to turn it around. Same thing as Miles Turner. Like, I looked up what he's shooting from the field. He's shooting 36% from the field this series and like 20-something percent from three. And honestly, it feels worse than that, to be totally honest with you. Like, every single time Miles Turner takes a shot, I don't know about you, I just expect it to miss. I can't remember the last time he's taken a shot with, and I was like, wow, that's a great look, that should fall. It just isn't going to happen. So it's kind of funny that the starting center for one of the teams is my most unlikely hero, but at least on the offensive end of the court, the odds that he gets hot are pretty low, but, you know, I guess we've seen crazier shit happen. The funniest picks for Game 7 heroes, it would be Kenrich Williams for OKC. Like, Sneaky, I think, leads the entire series in plus-minus for OKC, which is kind of hilarious to think about. Solid role player there. And then the funniest option, or the funniest hero for the Indiana Pacers would be Tony Bradley. Actually gave them some really good minutes in the second quarter last game. Now that he's back and healthy, we're certainly not going to see Thomas Bryant under any circumstance tomorrow unless it's like a late-game rebound or foul situation, something like that. But Tony Bradley's big as shit, so maybe he makes some noise, disrupts the game. But ultimately, my picks for who's going to be the Game 7 hero on either side. For OKC, I'm going to start with Aaron Wiggins. He's definitely the type of role player that all it takes is one shot to go in before he's going to have supreme confidence on the court. The three-point shooting overall from OKC has been abysmal in this series. I didn't even mention it earlier. I think they made a total of 8 threes in Game 6, which, again, isn't that surprising when you consider the blowout nature. But they were not a bad shooting team this entire season long. And Aaron Wiggins was a massive part of that. You know, he's not just a shooter, he's a great get you a bucket guy in the right spot as well. Pretty solid defender overall, and so I just feel like he's been up and down. It's been a roller coaster for him all series, but playing in front of the home court, I think he's pretty likely to pop off. And OKC just really needs somebody that they feel confident stepping into the game and taking shots from deep. And then Obi Toppin, I mean, he's been the third leading scorer for Indiana all series long. Had some massive games, not just his energy, you know, getting to the basket, being a lob threat, but the three-point shooting has been massive, and that's been relatively new to Toppin's game this year. And so I'm not really, you know, zagging too much by saying Obi Toppin's going to be the hero. I did want to give some credit to Trill Withers on Twitter, at TylerIam, probably my favorite personality and really all of sports media. You know, he tweeted, like, during Game 6, he's like, "What will you do when Obi Toppin hits 7 threes on Sunday night?" And I was like, that one hits. I could see that happening. I think he would immediately be a hero. Knicks fans would really want to kill themselves after they gave him away for free a couple off seasons ago. So who knows? One thing is for sure is that there is going to be a hero on each side of the ball in Game 7. And obviously, I'm not picking guys like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Jalen Williams, Pascal Siakam, Tyrese Haliburton. That's too obvious. You know, I'm just interested to see which one of those names that we said are going to end up stepping up tomorrow night. Some other things that I'm watching for in the game is just the coaching advantage that I feel like Indiana has developed at this point. You know, Mark Daigneault, you know, coach of the year last year. He might have even been coach of the year this year. I can't remember at this point. But it just feels like Carlisle has just been so dialed in with his rotations, getting the most out of his guys. Indiana seems to know who they are a lot more than OKC, where some of like the lineup decisions and things that they are doing as far as substitutions just don't really seem to be consistent and don't really seem to be adding up on the OKC side of things. And I just wonder now that Indiana, being the team that is still kind of punching uphill in this matchup, if there's any curveballs, is there any way that Carlisle really just kind of goes off the track to try to catch OKC off guard, especially playing on the road in this Game 7 matchup? Like, we haven't seen much zone from Indiana, much at all, and I think that it comes back to how comfortable they feel with the Nembhard matchup on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, so it'd be interesting to see if that's a card that they play. It would be interesting if they decide to move away from the Aaron Nesmith on Jalen Williams matchup that we talked a little bit about earlier. You know, does he lean into Pascal Siakam in that matchup a little bit more? You know, does he play Obi Toppin more minutes and put him on Jalen Williams? I don't really know what takes place there, but those are just a few things that I'm watching, but I definitely feel like Indiana's best advantage heading into tomorrow night is the advantage they have in the coaching department. And finally, just to wrap all this up, I don't want to get too in the weeds on this because inevitably we're going to know the winner in a little over 24 hours and we're going to have plenty of time to dissect the legacy of whatever team pulls this off. But just to set the stage a little bit here and lay out the stakes for each team if they were to win, if OKC wins this matchup, I think that Shea, you know, despite having a little bit of an up and down finals here, I think he's going to be pretty much widely anointed as the best player in the world. I'm not saying he deserves this. I'm just telling you what is going to happen, right? If he's able to pull off a scoring title, an NBA MVP, and a finals MVP all in the same season. And I think people are ultimately, if OKC wins this, they're going to come around a little bit. Like, I think there's going to be some frustration of like, wow, it took you 7 games to beat the Pacers, whatever. But most of America should be bought in that the Pacers have some shit going on where they are no joke and that they belong. And I think that OKC's definitely earned their stripes one way or another by being in this series and, you know, surviving this long of a playoff road. And I still think that people are going to say Shea is the best player of the world if he's able to pull this off. Obviously, a lot of that rides on his performance itself in Game 7, but I am expecting Shea to play well tomorrow night. I'm also expecting that Jalen Williams, a guy that's gotten a lot of love the past, like, 3 days or so, he and Shea are going to be looked at as the best duo in the NBA. It happens that quickly, people. I'm not kidding you at all. So I will say that Jalen Williams has really impressed me. I think he's primed for a big Game 7. And if those two have even decent Game 7s, they will be considered the best duo in the NBA. And I think long-term for OKC, if they're able to win tomorrow night, they're going to be even better positioned moving forward than what people expected of them before this playoff run, right? Like, before this playoff run, people are looking at it like, wow, OKC has all the talent. They're the best team on paper in the NBA. They have all these draft picks. They're so young. Like, they're so well situated to go on a massive run here. And then as they kind of struggled along, like, you know, going 7 games against Denver, now going 7 games against Indiana, there's people like, hey, were they as good as what we thought? But ultimately, it doesn't really matter what we think of the Thunder. I think they're going to have supreme confidence heading into next year's postseason, knowing that they were able to survive 2 different Game 7s, including one in the NBA Finals. Like, that is how you earn your playoff stripes, is being in moments like this and surviving and finding a way to win. Because all that matters is if you end up coming out on top. Doesn't matter how many games it took. Doesn't matter if you got beat by 30 the game before in Game 6. Nobody's going to remember any of that shit if you just find a way to win. And I do think OKC is going to be even scarier for the rest of the league to deal with if they're able to survive Game 7 tomorrow night. Now, on the other side of the coin, if Indy is able to win tomorrow night and pull this off, you know, I would have to do a little bit more deep diving into NBA history, but of my lifetime, I can say that this would be the most unexpected title run, point blank period. This leads into my next point. The other team that really comes to mind is the 2011 Mavericks. Not because, like, you know, people didn't take them seriously or didn't believe in Dirk or anything like that. I mean, there's a little bit of those sentiments, but it was really just like the road that that 2011 Mavericks team took. Like, you know, they beat Kobe along the way. They beat a young OKC team along the way. They ended up beating, of course, you know, LeBron, Wade, and Bosh in the Miami Heat in the finals. Like, that was just such a ridiculous run for that team and that player specifically, and Dirk Nowitzki, that, you know, that's going to be the other one there in my lifetime that comes to mind. But I still think on paper, you know, Indiana being a 4 seed, not having anybody heading into this postseason run that was universally considered as a superstar player, like, the chips were just so stacked against Indiana. Would truly be one of the most unexpected title runs of all time. The next thing that would take place if Indy wins is, I think you could make a sneaky GOAT argument for Rick Carlisle. And I'm not kidding about this. Like, it sounds crazy to say out loud. But obviously, again, he was the coach of that 2011 Mavericks team that we just talked about. He's been widely considered one of the best coaches in the NBA for a long time now. And I think the differentiator when you look at, like, the historically great coaches and the ones on top, the all-time list, is that those guys have had generational players for the majority of their career, right? Guys like Phil Jackson, who coached Kobe and MJ, right? Guys like Red Auerbach, who coached Bill Russell on that insane 60s Celtics group. Guys like Greg Popovich that had the opportunity to have Tim Duncan and David Robinson in his orbit for years and years, and later Parker and Ginobili and everything like that. Like, yes, Carlisle had Dirk with the Mavericks and, you know, has had some other stars that he's coached along the way, but I don't think anybody on that level where it just puts you in title contention every single year, and especially with this Pacers group. Again, you know, Pascal Siakam, Tyrese Haliburton, they're fantastic players, but, you know, most would not have considered them superstars heading into this postseason. So if you really believe in the X's and O's and elevating your team to the highest level possible, Rick Carlisle definitely has an argument to be made as one of the best coaches of all time already. But, you know, getting a second ring, putting him in that conversation would move him into a whole new class. Pascal Siakam, he would immediately be a lock to be a first ballot NBA Hall of Famer. This man would have 2 championships, and I'm assuming if Indiana pulls it off, it's more likely than not that Pascal Siakam would be the NBA Finals MVP to go on his resume. And again, Siakam's a great player, just never really thought about him all that much. Like, he's on the bubble to be an all-star most years. So to have a player like that be a lock to be a first ballot NBA Hall of Famer is a pretty crazy leap to make, but Siakam has a chance to do that. I think the most annoying thing that'll happen if Indiana wins is like a lot of interesting conversations about Tyrese Haliburton. And I think a lot of people are going to leapfrog him past fantastic all-time point guards that never won a title. Guys that come to mind are Chris Paul, Steve Nash. He obviously has the back-to-back MVPs. So, you know, maybe that gives Nash a little bit longer leash there. But people are going to put Haliburton above those guys, and they're immediately going to consider him the best point guard of his generation. You know, obviously there's a little break there between him and Steph. I would have to consider that being a different generation. No one's putting him above Steph. But beyond that, like, he's leaping, you know, those a lot of point guards on the all-time leaderboard pretty quickly, especially if he has a big Game 7 performance and gets Finals MVP. Again, not saying I agree with you. I'm just telling you what's going to happen. And of course, you know, the last thing I'll say is that TJ McConnell is already immortalized as like one of the most beloved role players ever for what he's done during this postseason run in the NBA Finals specifically. But if he has a big Game 7, like, forget about it. He's already reached legend status in Indiana. So I wanted to draw attention to that as well. And finally, I don't think anybody's waiting to hear what I have to say about my actual prediction as far as what to expect in the game tomorrow. But I'm expecting it to be tight. You know, I'm expecting it to be a low-scoring game. These Game 7s always are. Like, guys are truly so nervous in moments like this. You just cannot put into words a one-and-done March Madness situation for the NBA title. What is going through all these guys' heads? So I expect it to be tight. I expect there to be a lot of runs. Not necessarily big game-changing swings here, but I think that teams are going to be doing their scorings in runs of 6 to 8 points. When you are playing in a game where it's tight, where it's low scoring, and there are a lot of runs, it does make it likely that if one team just kind of gets hot and rides that momentum for a while, it's probably more likely that it's OKC, that it could end up being a blowout, but I am going to expect it to stay close. I'm not going to get cute here and pick Indiana. I do think it's still going to be OKC that finds a way to pull it out. They're at home. They have the better team, at least on paper. But I'm telling you, I think I'm rooting for Indiana. So I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth. I've just been so sucked in to the underdog in this situation where I am unbiased, kind of third party. My team obviously isn't in it. And I've just been so sucked into this run for the Pacers. I just find myself rooting for them to get back in the game every time they're down, just because I didn't think that they had any chance heading into this. So I think it's going to be OKC. I'm hoping it's Indiana, but above all else, just watch and enjoy, because we do not get many opportunities like this. As we said before, this is the first Game 7 that we've had in 9 years. Win or go home. Even if you're not a sports fan, you know, get your parents to watch, you know, get your girlfriend to watch, get that person in your life that doesn't watch basketball, get somebody else watching this game, because it's going to be a lot of fun and I can't wait. So that's going to do it for this podcast today. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this little preview. Hopefully you're as excited for the game as I am. I should be back on most likely Monday just to kind of recap Game 7 and talk about our new 2025 NBA champion, whoever that may be. But before I let you go, be sure to follow @WordsWithWallace on everything that includes Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to support @WordsWithWallace on social media as well. Enjoy Game 7 tomorrow night, and I will talk to you guys on Monday. Peace.